Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 28th of September 2014. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Nick from Partially Obstructed View and James Martin Charlton. We're now going to talk about Dr. Scroggie's War at the Globe Theatre. This is a play by Howard Brenton and directed by John Dove. This is a partnership that's done quite well at the Globe, particularly with Anne Boleyn a few years ago and with a more recent one in Extremis. This play chiefly tells the story of a 19-year-old chandler's boy from the banks of the Thames who has got a scholarship to Oxford and has been taken under the wing of a rather friendly sort of aristocratic person who introduces him around. He's a smart boy. He enlists in the army in a decent regiment, the London Irish, and is discovered at a party because of his connections by Sir John French, the general in charge of the British Expeditionary Force in 1914, and is taken on as a junior intelligence officer. He struggles rather against this and feels that he's let people down because he has the urge to fight, and at last he gets, during the Battle of Loos, he gets the opportunity to fight for his country. He goes over the top but gets struck the shrapnel from an artillery shell and gets part of his face blown away. That's essentially what happens to him at the start. We also get the parallel story of the title character of this, Dr. Scroggie. Dr. Scroggie is an invention of the pioneering plastic surgeon Harold Gillies, and Dr. Scroggie is sort of a bringer of good cheer and a mischief maker, and he's really trying to pick up people whose, often it's their faces that have been destroyed and their self has been destroyed, and he tries to bring back them back from despair. And it's a fascinating play, this, and Harold Brenton is a really good writer and conveys this extremely well. I did find, though, some problems with this play. We have James Garnon playing Harold Gillies and also playing Dr. Scroggie, and he gets to wear a kilt and a shocking orange wig. The problem I have with this is that I didn't feel I saw enough of him. I mean, I always like to see James Garnon at the Globe. He's one of the Globe's regulars, and he is always a treat to see. But he's in this, we're told about Dr. Scroggie more than we actually see him. I mean, we do see him, and we do see him being fun, but we don't see enough of the way that he works. And in fact, his major interaction and his major sort of the way he does treatment is when Jack Twigg comes into the hospital at Sidcup to have plastic surgery and to be rebuilt. And Dr. Scroggie doesn't work on him. And we don't get enough of the success. We are told too much about his successes. We have nurses who've encountered Dr. Scroggie giggling about him. We've got patients who have clearly been cheered up by him, but we don't see him at work. And in fact, what we see is Dr. Scroggie failing. And it's a rather interesting thing that happened there. I didn't feel it would work. I didn't felt that I was being told and not shown about him. And that was a pity here. And this is a very minor point because this is a very strong play. I mean, I would say it was a good Howard Brenton play. I don't think it's a great one like Anne Boleyn or indeed other plays of Howard Brenton. I'm thinking particularly of Paul. And it definitely made me want to see more Howard Brenton. It always wants to make me see more Howard Brenton. I think I'd like to see a lot of his earlier plays if at all possible. I also felt that I've been rather spoiled by reading Robert Graves' book Goodbye to All That, which is his memoir of taking part in the First World War. He got severely injured and was reported dead and had an epitaph written by a poet friend of his called Siegfried Sassoon. And it's Robert Graves' talk about Siegfried Sassoon, which is echoed quite a lot in this play. Siegfried Sassoon won the MC. He was an extremely brave soldier. He turned completely against the war and would go on pacifist marches, make speeches about, you know, stopping the war. But at the same time, he was almost addicted to the war. And this is something that we see in Jack Twigg, a man who has been severely injured, would never be expected to fight again, but wants to go back. And there were apparently people like this. And in the same way that Siegfried Sassoon, Jack Twigg is not as anti-war as Siegfried Sassoon was, but Siegfried Sassoon desperately needed to get back to the front, get back to fighting, get back to being with the other soldiers and going through the same privations as they do. And he could have been prevented and stopped. And I think sometimes they even use that to control Siegfried Sassoon. You know, you can't, if you keep going on about pacifism, we're not going to let you fight, which is a bizarre thing. And you get this feeling with Jack Twigg of this man who has an absolute need to go back and to fight, and in some ways to prove himself, and sees the sort of Dr. Scroggy as a distraction from that. You know, all he wants to do is get back to the front, and he's not interested in Dr. Scroggy. So, I mean, there are lots of fascinating questions about this play, and I think it is it's a good play, as I said. I'm not sure that it was an absolutely great play. Nick, what did you think about it?
Yeah, I think it is kind of, the title is maybe a bit misleading, because actually, as you say, we don't meet the kind of fictional Dr. Scroggy until the second act, and we only actually see Gillies once briefly in the first act. So it very much is Jack Twigg's story, and I think Will Featherstone does very well to carry the show, especially since, you know, it can't be easy to spend the entire second act with your whole face bandaged up and trying to kind of anchor a show. So I think he's very impressive in that. I think the problem with theatres doing seasons based on something like a centenary is that by the time you get to September, it's clearly not diminished the importance of the story they're telling, but you do feel like you've seen the story a lot of times before. And I think this is what Howard Brenton's very good at, is finding the different story in the more familiar piece of history, and that is of Gillies and the pioneering plastic surgery and how much he influenced clearly what happened afterwards, you know, used kind of the horrific injuries that happened to people to kind of perfect both making life better for them and then down the line creating these kinds of surgery that would be used to this day on people with kind of needing facial reconstruction. But I think that is the thing, is I think we don't see quite enough of either of his alter egos, either Gillies or Scroggy. And it is a bit odd that we do see the story of his failure rather than of his many successes. But I agree. I think it's a very, very strong play. It's very well put together. And, you know, year after year, we see that writers seem to have immense problems writing for the Globe. And Brenton really doesn't. I mean, he's back here for the third time, I think, with a new play. And he's just so comfortable writing for that space, which strangely very few writers seem to be, modern writers, obviously. So I think it's so far, I've not seen Pitcairn yet, but so far this is by far the best of the new plays at the Globe this year. And I would say it's definitely worth a look, but it does kind of, it could do with more of the title character, really, or what, not just the, I don't just mean the kind of the comedy character, Dr. Scroggy. I think we could have seen more of Gillies and kind of where he's coming from and his successes, as well as this kind of one notable failure. But it's far from saying this that it's a bad play. It's a very good play. It just feels slightly frustrating in that respect.
We're now going to talk about True West by Sam Shepard. This is Sam Shepard's 1980 play and arrives at the Tricycle from the Glasgow Citizens Theatre, where it's been directed by Philip Breen. It concerns a young screenwriter who's house-sitting his mother's house in Hollywood while he gets on with the script, and suddenly his brother, a drifter and a thief who appears to have lived rough in the Mojave Desert for several years, turns up, and we see what happens from then. Nick, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
The character is Austin, who's played by Eugene O'Hare, is the screenwriter, and he's sort of a nervous, slightly kind of nerdy character, but he's sort of working in Hollywood and just on the brink of making a big break with a screenplay when his brother Lee, who's played by Alex Ferns, turns up. And he's a sort of drifter who we sort of get told that this is probably not too far from what their father was like, and he kind of spends his life wandering around in the deserts, kind of communing with nature. And when he does come into the city, it's mainly to burgle people's houses. So there's this obvious kind of clash going on between them. But what sort of extends this and forces them together longer than they would like is that the producer who's planning on buying Austin's script, here's a treatment kind of that Lee comes up with off the top of his head, and unfortunately makes a ill-advised bet, which if he loses it, he'll have to produce that script instead of his brother's one. And that obviously he loses the bet, and Lee's completely nonsensical treatment is the one that they have to write the script for now. So it is this situation of the two of them being thrown together for longer than they would like. And there's a lot of shouting, there's a lot of alcohol, and there's a lot of destruction to the set. And I really can't fault the production. I can't fault the performances. I mean, they're just excellent. I haven't seen the play before. I know it's kind of considered both an American classic and one of the National Theatre's 100 best plays of the 20th century. And I can sort of see where that's coming from, but I really didn't warm to the play at all. And I think it's because I could see its workings. I really didn't feel involved in it at all, because in a way that these two characters are sort of both embodiments of the American dream. Obviously, one of them is sort of rough and living on the streets sort of thing, but there's certainly this kind of fantasy in America of kind of going out and conquering nature, and that's kind of what Lee represents. And then Austin might be a kind of nerdier sort of less confident character, but he's working in Hollywood, which again is one of these things that's sort of used as the very example of making it in America. And so the play is kind of about both these people who sort of in a way embody the American dream, and neither of whom is quite happy with it, and both would kind of secretly like to be the other a bit. And it's very clever, and I just never really felt involved in it. And I think also it's just a bit too intense. There's something I call multiple ending syndrome, which I will be, I think, complaining about a bit later today as well. But it's this thing where sort of the last half hour of the play all feels like a climax, and you think you're coming to the end, and there's always one more scene and one more scene, and it kind of it builds a bit too early and feels like it's about to end too early, so it just becomes exhausting by the end. And this has that, not really at the ending, this has it from about 20 minutes in. So I absolutely admire the actors for managing to keep that energy up throughout, but you know, is every scene feels like the Oscar clip scene, and I found that tiring, and I found it just after a while becomes hard to get sucked into, and it just strangely left me cold. It's one of those that, you know, you feel like I really should have been absolutely engrossed by this, but it left me cold, and I'm not entirely sure why.
I also have problems with this play in that it's the play, it's not the production at all. I mean, the very fine performances, and Alex Ferns is completely mad in this. It's really quite impressive. Although I have to say, if he's been there for weeks, surely he would have had a shower. And I just felt grimy on his behalf a lot of the time, because he is his character of Lee is just so dirty, and you just think, come on, he's been there for a couple of weeks, please let him have had a shower at some point. You know, I can accept him being dressed in rags, but it's there is this kind of gleeful wanton destruction that they're putting on the page, the way that everything breaks down, and you get some, you know, it's wonderful prop work in many ways. I mean, the destructiveness of the set, the way that they destroy the set, the way that they bring in, I mean, there's a theft part, and we get large numbers of toasters brought on and large amounts of toast being made and thrown around the place. And there is that kind of glee and the destructiveness of it. And I think I've seen this in one or two other Sam Shepard plays. I can't remember the one that was on at the Donmar, which was, it had the same way that the relationships simply just break down, and it really is, they're just returning to two fighting, squabbling kids, but this time they've got a lot more alcohol and a lot more things to break, and they can break things much more effectively. It works like that, but yeah, the play in many ways doesn't make sense. I mean, that is the central idea of of how he gets that script and how, okay, it's a bet, but he seems to win the script by a bet, but suddenly the producer is all about his script. It's not, you know, he's not just having lost the bet, but he does seem to be convinced by it. And it really doesn't make any sense to me. And I think that's deliberate, but it doesn't really help. And all you're ending up with is, as I said, the gleeful destruction of the set as you go around, as their relationship sort of breaks down and they almost swap roles in many ways. We're now going to talk about Albion at the Bush Theatre. This is a new play by Chris Thompson and is directed by Rhea Parry. Chris Thompson had his debut play, Carthage, premiered at the Finborough earlier this year, and I think we might have talked about it. It was about a young boy taken into care and the way that the care system didn't work for him, and eventually he died as a result of his inability to cope inside the system. This play is about a young boy called Jason, a young man obsessed by karaoke. He runs karaoke nights in his brother's pub, which is called the Albion, and he runs them pretty much every night of the week, and he's always the first up on the microphone to belt out songs. And this is what the play does a lot of the time. We get the theme of karaoke coming through, so it's like a jukebox musical where you're picking songs to explain the plot in many ways, although in some ways the plot is governed by the songs rather than the plot leading the songs, because of course you're having to pick songs that suit the mood rather than making a song to suit the mood, so you're governed by that idea. His brother, the landlord of the Albion, is also the head of a right-wing anti-immigration party called the EPA, English Protection Army. And the brother, Paul, is a good speech maker inside the pub, and he seems to be, at first, an effective leader of the EPA. We see him trying to protect a step-niece of his. She's a stepdaughter of his sister. She was briefly married to a man, so it's a rather complicated story, and he doesn't have much into it, but he sees that she's being groomed by a group of Asian men, and he tries to do something about it. And he runs up against a young woman called Christine, who is unable to do anything to help him, doesn't really believe him at first, and is constrained by overly politically correct people who don't want to demonize Asian men and don't want to believe that young women are being groomed in this way. And it's very prescient. Well, not necessarily prescient, but it is up to the headlines. But we focus on these three characters. Jason is gay. His boyfriend is an Asian. Paul is quite accepting of his brother's homosexuality, and himself has a best friend and a deputy in the English Protection Army who's the son of Jamaican immigrants. So it does make his right-wingness and his anti-immigration doesn't quite work in some ways. It's a little bit downplayed by his personal relationships. He can't quite be the vicious man that perhaps his instincts tell him to be, and in some ways it makes him weak. And when he encounters Christine for the second time, when the scandal of the Asian men's grooming of the young girls has broken and she's been sort of used as a scapegoat, she shows herself as a much more effective operator politically than he is. He's good for the pubs and the public meetings, but he's not good on television or media, and she is, and we see that building over the time. And all this is punctuated, as I said, by people belting out karaoke songs. So we get a lot of, I think, a lot of good performances. I was particularly impressed by Natalie Casey as Christine. She's an actress who I don't always like, but she was really good in this and very, very effective, and she seems to have found a very good level. And she also can deliver a song very well. You also have Stephen John Sheppard as Paul and Tony Clay as Jason. We're also very effective. What do you think about this, Nick?
I absolutely loved this. I thought it was an incredibly impressive piece of work. I mean, I would have described it quite differently, because I think really the focus of the piece is on the fact that Paul has sort of quite high profile in the party. He's got the character played by Delroy Atkinson, who is the fiance of his sister, as the deputy. So he's got a black face as a kind of public face of the party, and he similarly has his brother as an openly gay face of the party. So it's I think really this is what Chris Thompson is looking at, is that it's kind of a modern sort of face of the right, which is kind of is still absolutely hateful towards the minority they decide they don't like, which in this case is Muslims. Their platform is very much one of kind of Sharia law being introduced into the UK and them trying to stop it. So they're absolutely kind of filled with hate and bigotry. But because they have certain minorities who they're not particularly prejudiced against, they kind of use these two as an excuse to kind of say that this isn't who we are. We can't be we can't be bigoted because we like black people and we like gay people. And of course, within that, there's also the fact that belonging to a minority doesn't preclude anybody from being bigoted against another one. So it's a complicated sort of starting point. And I think it's a really kind of bold way of it plays very often almost like a rom-com. And I think what it's trying to do is, because you often hear about that you need to understand kind of dangerous and hateful people, not call them sort of monsters. And this takes it to the extent that you kind of do enjoy your time with them, because what he's saying is that these aren't alien people. They are people who are almost exactly like anybody with kind of more middle of the road beliefs. It's just and this is what's so dangerous about them, is that it's not, you know, they're not walking down the street with the horns and bright red eyes. They're you know, people you actually enjoy their company until it becomes apparent that there's this edge to them that is just repellent. And I think it's a very bold approach, and it's one that I think works very well. And I think the other thing that is really interesting about it is that he chooses to tell the story through the karaoke, which is I mean, for someone who's only on his second play, it's kind of a sort of experimental structure that you don't see much more experienced playwrights going for. And I think, I mean, for the most part, I think it works, because you can kind of feel him playing with the format as it goes through. So there's not sort of a single way that the music works. You do often see sort of a caption as to what the song is that is theming the next scene in the style of a karaoke screen where the song title would come on. And so sometimes it literally is a scene where somebody is doing that in the karaoke, since that is the setting. Then other times it is done like a musical, with the song being rearranged for sort of multiple singers. Other times it's sort of punctuation. There's moments where the characters will dip in and out of the song, alternating it with a dialogue, so it kind of becomes part of the dialogue. And so I think it's an incredibly exciting play to watch. I know it's really divided people, and I think not so much in the kind of serious political point it's trying to make. I think people generally appreciate the point it's trying to make there. I think in the style of it, I know that there are people who absolutely hated it. I just found it incredibly exciting to watch this kind of experimentation in style, and to see this kind of it's just so nicely performed. And there's an incredibly complex character at the middle of it in Jason. I think on stage this is Tony Clay's professional debut. I think he's done screen work before, but I think this is his first stage role, and he's very impressive in it. And he's a sort of gay character you don't often see in any drama, certainly not mainstream drama, where, you know, his sexuality is not the only thing that defines him. That he's, you know, he's not a very bright character. He's easily led, and he's incredibly kind of confused about everything. And this is where the karaoke really comes in. It's kind of what it's his distraction from what his family and he ultimately are all about. You know, it's his way of coping, is if he makes karaoke what defines his personality. And that's kind of broken down quite nicely near the end. It does have, I mean, really, this is the one thing that I found fault with it, is that it does have this multiple ending syndrome thing going on, where for the last sort of 10, 15 minutes, there's about three or four scenes that feel like the final scene, and you kind of feel like it's repeating itself, and it's kind of said what it needs to and could have gone out on more of a sort of explosive ending rather than dragging it out. But apart from that, I think it's something I'm definitely recommending, but with the proviso that it's clearly not everybody's cup of tea, but it really impressed me.
We're now going to talk about An Enemy of the People, which has been on at the Barbican this week. This is Schabioner Berlin's production, directed by Thomas Ostermeyer, of Henrik Ibsen's play. I first actually encountered Enemy of the People in Alf Miller's translation, which I think was rather sympathetic towards Stockman, Dr. Stockman, who is, in a more literal translation I saw later, is a more arrogant and self-aggrandizing character. He's not actually a particularly sympathetic character in the play. He has lots of weaknesses. In this production, I also found echoes of Public Enemy, which is a version of Enemy of the People done last year, written by David Harrower and directed by Richard Jones at the Young Vic. But of course, this production is actually oddly older. What this production does is it has certain changes from the original play. It makes the Stockman's considerably younger. It conflates Dr. Stockman's wife and daughter, which makes for an interesting subplot with Hofstadt, who is the editor of the local paper. And the Stockmans have a hipsterish band getting together with Hofstadt and the revolutionary reporter Billing, who is in many ways somebody who pretends to be a revolutionary but not, is a bit too much of a conformist, as it turns out. I mean, that is in the original piece, I think. The most interesting innovation, I think, in this play is that they replace Stockman's Act 4 speech. It's a meeting held at a sympathiser's house. They replace the speech he makes there, which originally contains lots of ideas that sound disturbingly like eugenics. But here they take that out and give us what are excerpts from a French anarchist manifesto called The Coming Insurrection. We're actually presented at the beginning of the play, as we're sitting down, with a big projection of a passage from that, which contains an indictment of the phrase, I am what I am, when it's used as a marketing slogan. What we see is really, at first, is just a tirade of abuse, which doesn't really explain itself. But I think it is later explained in Dr. Stockman's speech, where he talks about, well, what I took away from it, he talks about this acceptance of individualism, the acceptance of everybody is a unique little flower, actually has the effect of isolating people and making their voices and their views less important, because if everybody's view is important, then nobody's is. If everybody is special, then essentially nobody is. If everybody's super, then nobody is. I mean, obviously, I might be wrong, but I'm not absolutely sure what it has to do with the poisoning of the baths. And I think it's really replacing the rather disturbing, as I said, eugenics ideas with something which is much more populist. And this is one of the interesting features he then does. What happens is that Dr. Stockman in this production gets interrupted by Aslaksen, the owner of the newspaper, who comes on the stage, asks for the house lights to be raised, and then talks to the audience and tries to get them to respond. It's always a bit dangerous when you do something like that, because you sometimes have to fake it. I've been in productions, I've actually been sitting next to the people faking it in productions, and absolutely, perhaps, I was in the stage seats and suddenly people standing up next to me revealed themselves to be actors and made interruptions in the play. And other times it's done very badly, often this audience participation, because you can't really get people going. Fortunately, on the night I went, there was somebody sitting behind me who was extremely eloquent. I'm not absolutely sure that he wasn't fake, but he was eloquent and he did sound real. And you had other people interrupting and talking and debating, in fact, rather fruitlessly, because everybody kind of agreed with Stockman at the time and didn't agree with Aslaksen, and he just brushed it off like a politician, although his character, slightly against his character, which at first seemed rather nervous, he then mutates into this rather smooth politician. And then it sort of extricated itself rather cleverly from that, because after all, if let's say somebody had gone along to disrupt it and knew the about the manifesto and had a very good way of arguing against, you know, that what Dr. Stockman was rubbish, they could have actually elongated that and we would have been there all night. But I think they closed it down very well. It didn't feel forced or artificial, which I was really quite impressed by, actually. Because Dr. Stockman then sort of apparently picks up on what somebody said and then delivers the rest of his speech, and it becomes slightly less acceptable, say, to, not necessarily to the audience, but certainly to the actors in the audience who are there to boo him, and he gets pelted with paint bombs, well, balloons full of paint. And the last major change I'll talk about is in the fifth act. It's always sort of been a to me in this play, it's a sort of a tidy up, you know, they're discussing what he's going to do next, and there is this plot of Stockman's father-in-law buying up all the shares in the baths, which are contaminated, believing that Stockman is just pulling a fast one and faking his belief in it, and basically putting all of his daughter's inheritance into those stocks and shares. And in this play, it's kind of emphasized in such a way that there's a possible way out of it. There's a possible way out of this, out of their situation, that they could actually make it better by doing the wrong thing, of taking advantage of their ownership of the baths to improve things. And I've not seen that done before. I mean, all in all, this is a very impressive, very simply staged in many ways, this production. It's a chalkboard scenery drawn on very roughly, simple tables and chairs just reused and reused over and over. Very simple, and it felt very real. There was, of course, the problem of the language. This is all played in German. We were watching the subtitles, and there is always a slight problem with when you're dealing with, especially with German, is that we will read the surtitles, we will get what they're saying and react to it before they've actually got to the verb in German, which is always a slight problem. Now, James, you have seen a lot more Ostermeyer. Is this a good Ostermeyer? Is this a typical, do you think?
I certainly think it's a very good Ostermeyer. I've seen three other productions. I saw his Nora, which is the version of A Doll's House that he brought to the Barbican a few years ago. And I saw a production of a play by John Fosse, I think it was, that he did at Edinburgh about a decade ago. And I saw a version he did of A Midsummer Night's Dream in Berlin. And this, along with Nora, is one of the best things of his I've seen. He seems to be particularly good at doing Ibsen. And so, yeah, it's certainly similar to Nora in that it updates the play so that the characters we're watching are sort of yanked out of the 19th century and sort of plonked down in our society. And the sorts of people that might go to the Sorbonne in Berlin and also to the Barbican are very much the sorts of people that you see on stage. So he's very good, I think, at making Ibsen real to us now. And this is different to Nora in that this is the first production of his I've seen that breaks the fourth wall in this way. He may do that in other productions, but he does this here. And whilst I was a bit unsure about it at first, I felt in the end that it really did work in that it sort of brought home the audience's, in a way, complicity in the story. So that not necessarily the things that the audience were saying were particularly relevant to an enemy of the people, because I went this afternoon. I'm not sure when you went, but I went this afternoon, and the discussion was, it's sort of a lot of people, I'd say about two thirds of the audience sort of stuck their hands out and agreed with Stockman, this anarchist speech. But then very quickly, a number of people sort of began challenging that. And there was quite a good debate went on that sort of encompassed such thing as, should one engage in debates with conservatives? And if one doesn't, is one then perhaps not a Democrat? And then someone else talked about, if we stopped consuming, then the whole economy might well die. And people would also talk about the cost of the ticket at the Barbican and how could the people who were there in the audience at the Barbican possibly sort of buy into this idea of rejecting consumerism when there we all are in our, you know, very nice clothes, you know, our very expensive theatre seats, probably all with our iPhones in our pockets and all that sort of thing. But that all served, I thought, to sort of make us complicit in this world, in the world of the play, in which we all really have something to lose if the truth comes out. And there were a number of people in the audience who were suggesting that really what the production was about was climate change. And so the truth about climate change and the truth about the baths became in the discussion very sort of intermingled, really. And I thought this was quite strong because it really sort of brought across the idea that, well, perhaps a number of us might feel that climate change is caused by the sort of society we live in. But most of us, certainly most of us sitting there in the Barbican today, have a lot to lose if the sort of society we live on in stops functioning in the way it did. So in that way, I felt that what he did was really sort of draw out the meaning of Ibsen's play and sort of draw it off of the stage and sort of put it in the middle of the audience. And I felt he did this with Nora as well, not in quite in so obvious a way. He didn't break the fourth wall, but he did sort of make Nora's act at the end very sort of now. So we really understood what a radical act it was that she was doing. So I think that's really the strength of a good Ostermeyer production, that he makes these sort of very old, in a way, quite sort of crusty plays, something which very much speaks to us now, while still keeping the sort of spirit, the revolutionary spirit of the plays, which obviously offended audiences and made audiences think and all that sort of thing when they were originally produced.
I mean, I found this possibly the best version of this play I've seen so far, I have to say. And it, as you say, it does feel very contemporary. I think we had a rather more compliant audience on Friday when I saw it, and I think they were rather more willing to accept everything that Stockman was saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the actor playing the publisher, I don't know whether we did this when you were there on Friday, but he sort of, after a good proportion of the audience stuck their hands up agreeing, he actually said, well, did you listen to what he was saying? Because what he was saying was fairly, you know, at the most extreme radical end of the green agenda, of a sort of anarchist agenda. And, you know, I wonder really whether a lot of people in the audience were sort of agreeing with the sort of, well, you know, we should tell the truth and sort of, you know, maybe stand up against those in power, but really didn't sort of follow the entire implications of what Stockman was saying. I found Stockman really interesting. Towards the end of the debate today, there was sort of a lot of people were saying how great Stockman was. And then someone, and this is what I was thinking myself, so I was glad someone said it. I didn't quite have the courage to shout it out myself. Someone said that he was vain. And I felt that this came across really strongly in the production, that here was a man who was in possession of a sort of truth, a dirty truth about society, but also was rather pleased with himself that he was in possession of this truth. When he first gets the letter and he first opens the letter, his first reaction is to smile. He's really sort of pleased. And then when he goes along to the publisher, he sort of says, well, I know you might be thinking of giving me a prize. And I thought that sort of the rather dubious nature of the character of the man came across very strongly in this production.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.